Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's episode, the Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be hosting the show today. So today, we have Jason Salomon. How are you doing today, Jason?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Doing well. We brought Jason on the show because we wanted to talk about 1031 exchanges and DSTs. We've gotten a lot of questions over the last year about 1031s. It's come up in a lot of conversations. We wanted to bring on an expert to talk about that topic. So Jason, maybe you can tell the listeners a little bit about your background.
Well, my name is Jason Salomon. I'm Senior Vice President at K Properties. We do specialize in private equity real estate as a kind of general wider description. And then as a subset of that, 1031 exchanges are a big part of our business and the Delaware statutory trust structure as well. I've come to this point by being on the other side of the business at the front end of my career, more on the research, analysis, report writing, data gathering. And then on this part of my career, kind of morphed and developed into private equity real estate through the course of a few decades. So now our day-to-day is helping investors find the right securitized real estate deals, fractional ownership real estate deals for their situation, whether it be for the 1031 exchange or as direct cash investments.
So when you say fractional real estate deals in kind of common term, what does that mean?
Well, it's that our firm, we work with real estate firms that go out and buy sizable real estate deals that are tens of millions of dollars in most cases. In some cases, they're hundreds of millions of dollars. And they'll go and they'll buy these properties. They'll come to us. We'll have a due diligence process to determine if the deal would or wouldn't be offered to our investors. And our investors, our clients, have the ability to participate in these real estate deals, but fractionally. So they own units of them, rather than going out and buying a $50 million apartment complex or $100 million or a portfolio of net leased real estate or a single asset, depending on what the asset class may be. So you'll see multifamily, you'll see self-storage, you'll see net leased real estate, a lot of, you know, more industrial distribution now than ever, I think. And you'll also see from, you know, now again, because of the aging population, a lot of healthcare related properties, certain types of assets our firm, for what it's worth, don't offer to our clients through our due diligence and risk tolerance. But these clients have the ability to buy in to real estate deals in most cases that they would not be able to on their own.
So I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about the 1031, because this topic comes up here and again. We don't spend much time on it, but can you explain it kind of a basic level, like how a 1031 exchange works?
So in and of itself, the like-kind exchange for real estate and property had been on the books for just about 100 years. It has developed over time, and kind of the modern era that we dwell in now was with the Starker Exchange in 79, I think it was thereabouts. And that put certain rules and protocol in place for how forward exchange would go. And what that means is, if somebody sells investment real estate, they have the ability to potentially defer their long-term capital gains tax, as well as potentially the depreciation recapture tax at a rate of 25%. State tax, if applicable, and perhaps also the Medicare surtax at 3.8%, potentially others, depending on structure and kind of where they're at. But if they own investment real estate and they sell, they can't take possession of the proceeds. The organization that takes possession of the proceeds for the sale is called a qualified intermediary. And they're the ones that enact the 1031 mechanically. So there's a few rules that are in place. The big rules on the timelines are really important. Once the qualified intermediary has funds from that sale transaction, there are 45 days to identify replacement real estate. And it's got to be a like-kind exchange. So what people often confuse as being like-kind is if they sell a condominium, a lot of people erroneously think they have to go buy another condo. Not so. So somebody could sell a condo, they can buy a ranch. They can sell a ranch and they can buy an apartment complex. You can sell an apartment complex and buy an industrial building. You can sell an office building and you can buy a bunch of rentals. Whatever it is, you've got to follow the timelines and the rules for the 1031 itself. So 45 days, one must identify replacement property, and concurrently, another timeline is 180 days from the closing where the investors have to close on the replacement property or the due date for taxes for the year in which the property was sold, whatever comes sooner. For the 45-day identification, often people think of what's called the three property rule. That's accurate. There's a three property rule. It means you can identify one, two, or three properties as replacements as long as you buy equal or greater real estate value. So that's really important. So if you sell something for $1 million without a loan, you have to buy roughly $1 million of real estate. You sell something for $1 million and you pay back a mortgage of $400,000 and $600,000, or there might be some closing costs, but let's call it $600,000 goes and sits in escrow with a qualified intermediary. One must take that $600,000 yet still buy equal or greater value as they've sold. So you got to either buy one, two, or three properties if that's what you've identified. If you don't use that rule, there's something called the 200% rule. And that basically just says you can identify up to 200% of what you relinquish property. You can identify, but you just have to buy equal or greater value. And then the third rule is called the 95%. And that basically says you can identify whatever you want as long as you close on 95% of what you identify. So three rules. And when we work with clients, we kind of figure out what makes sense for them based on our role, our job. But that's essentially, it might sound a little complicated, but just drilling down to the simplified version, sell investment real estate, you can't take possession of the proceeds. The proceeds go to a qualified intermediary. We call them QI for short. The QI then administers the 1031 exchange by way of identifying and then funding into the replacement property within certain timeline, buying equal or greater value. That's the 1031 of real estate, kind of in a nutshell.
Okay, so just to circle back, because you went through a lot, and this is great. So if somebody, let's say, owns a property worth $1 million and they have, you said, $600,000 in equity, it's the equity that has to be rolled into the new property, correct?
Yes and no. It is the equity that has to be rolled in, yet if they fall short of buying less than the total real estate value, then that would be called mortgage boot and potentially taxable. So boot is what you don't replace. So you would theoretically, say for instance, somebody sells, let's just call it a commercial property, $4 million, pays back a mortgage at closing of $400,000, the $600,000 is the equity, is the cash sitting with the qualified intermediary. If that investor goes and buys $600,000 of replacement property, they'd fall short by about $400,000. So that would be potentially taxable. So in theory, one would have to go out and get another mortgage and buy equal or greater value. The space that we dwell in with the private equity deals, you know, specifically the Delaware Statutory Trust, these deals either do or don't have debt already attached to them. Say, for instance, there's a deal out there that has a 50% loan to value, LTV. That means that what you see is what you get. So if somebody had, just keeping it simple, if somebody invests in that Delaware Statutory Trust with their $600,000, at closing, they will have bought $1.2 million of total real estate value with the financing already being attached to it, but not being recourse to the investor. It's a prepackaged real estate deal that in many cases acts as a 1031 vehicle. So they'll be able to get the benefit of that for closing and for the 1031 and then, you know, move forward. If somebody comes to me with $600,000 needing to buy $1 million of real estate, one of the great things about the Delaware Statutory Trust is that typically the minimums are $100,000 for accredited investors and accredited entities, and that gives people the ability to diversify. So if we work together with a client and we have, for instance, maybe 40 or 50 offerings for our clients to participate in, then we would be able to kind of mix and match various deals to get them where they want to go, depending on you know, what we call suitability, where they are in life, what their investor profile is, and where they've been, where they are now, and where they want to go. So again, one of the great things about the Del Oro Statutory Trust is the ability to diversify, but also have that debt in place for those that need it. And those that don't need a mortgage as replacement property for a 1031 could access deals that don't have any leverage on them, no debt. So it's, you know, a little of this and a little of that.
Yeah. So before we get into the DST, and just to clarify for the listeners, there's two DSTs. A month or two ago, we did an episode on deferred sales trust. This is different. This is the Delaware Statutory Trust, which is a very different vehicle, even though they have the same letters. But I wanted to ask more questions about the 1031 first. So, yeah. You know, when we're looking at 1031, let's say that, so the person sells their property and then they buy this other property. Are there holding requirements? Can they just 1031 it into another property like the next day? And just the way I'm thinking about this, let's say you want to sell the property, but you can't find something necessarily that fits perfectly and you want to do this again. Are there any requirements there to do this again?
The great thing about the 1031 is it's not really the end once you do it. It's section 1031 of the Internal Revenue Code. And then when you ultimately sell that replacement property, you have the ability to potentially defer your taxes again. As far as the timelines themselves, again, there's the very specific 45 and 180 day deadlines for reinvesting proceeds from a sale if you're going to do a 1031. And as long as you follow those, then you have the ability to move forward. As far as moving forward, how it might be, one should always consult their CPA and attorney regarding tax advice. We're not able to give it, but what Uncle Sam is looking for is the intent to be a long-term investor. So it's all about the intent to be. So if you're kind of flipping or you're hopping in and out, you'll have to consult with your people about that as to whether or not they think that you're applicable for a 1031 exchange. And that's really important. That's regarding your relinquished property, but it's also regarding, you know, what you might go into going forward. But by and large, it's all about the intent and then the timelines follow into that. But because everybody's situation is different and unique to them, they should always consult with their own tax professionals for guidance on that part of it.
You know, you mentioned something and I want to just kind of point this out. So it sounds to me like, let's just say you buy a property and you're going to sell it and you're going to buy another property. Do you ever have to pay taxes on this if you keep pushing it forward, or what's the limit on that?
Death.
Death and taxes.
So, yeah. That's why this is here for real estate investors. It's the ability to do that. There's really no way out of it. You have to pay what you owe if you choose to not do it, a tax-deferred like-kind 1031 exchange. But if you're doing these 1031 exchanges, they, in a lot of cases, could be part of one's own estate plan so that ultimately, when they go to the pearly gates, then their beneficiaries could potentially get a step up in basis, just like other types of investments.
Interesting. So you could be investing for 40, 50 years and never pay capital gains tax or all the other taxes that come along with the sale on real estate, do it multiple times, and on death, it gets stepped up, and then your heirs don't pay capital gains either.
We have a lot of clients that have, we call it rolling over. They've rolled over. So they've had real estate, they've done a 1031 exchange, done it several iterations of it time and time again. They've come to a point where they don't want to chase tenants around, or they don't want to manage their real estate, or they want diversification. They ultimately come to us and then have the ability to do a 1031 exchange, you know, again, into hands-off stuff. And then once each of those sell, have the opportunity again to do a 1031 exchange and then keep going. And we see that all the time. So this is really just a 1031 is a continuum of tax deferral. Now, again, there could be certain municipalities or locales that would have certain taxable bits to it, but big ones that I mentioned earlier, i.e. capital gains, depreciation recapture tax, state tax, again, if applicable, and then the Medicare surtax are the ones that would be potentially deferred through 1031 exchange.
And the 1031, it only applies to real estate, correct? I couldn't just sell my car and buy a new one, right?
So during the reform a few years ago, some things changed around for personal property. But if you go back to the like kind in quotation marks aspect of the 1031, the reason that like kind, again, when I clarified where if you sell the ranch and you buy, I don't remember what my example was, but say an apartment building or sell the apartment building and buy distribution or what have you, that's the like kind aspect of it. Where the like kind was not applicable was where if you sold artwork, you couldn't buy real estate as replacement property. If you sold real estate, you couldn't buy an airplane. So businesses through the 1031 exchange historically had been able to utilize certain things, and also investors, private investors had been able to utilize aspects of property with respect for depreciation or appreciation in the like-kind exchange. That's something that one should always, again, consult with their tax advisors on where that is. But, you know, during the tax reform several years back, that changed. Notwithstanding, the 1031 exchange is like-kind for real estate, stayed intact.
Yeah, because I know a lot of our listeners own planes. So there's a big, big market out there for buying and selling planes.
You know, farm equipment or things like that, vehicles for businesses, et cetera. Those things were kind of all things in a different subset of the 1031. But as far as the real estate aspects of it, again, for what it's worth, it stayed completely in the realm of where it had been for years and was unaffected by that reform a few years back.
One question that comes to mind. So let's say I own this big building and I'm selling it. Do I have to buy one big building or can I buy like 10 other buildings?
You can buy 10 other buildings. As long as you follow one of those three rules that we outlined earlier, then you can absolutely do that. You have to stay within the, I mean, if you buy 10 buildings, you're not going to be observing the three property rule. So you can throw that one out the window, but you would potentially be able to utilize the 200% rule or the 95%, depending on the situation, depending on your ability to close on what you identify. So those would come into it. But yeah, I mean, using your example, if you sold one and you bought 10, if there's a way and you follow those rules, you could absolutely do that.
Well, that's good to know. So now getting into the DST, the Delaware Statutory Trust, do these two interrelate or are they separate?
They interrelate in that the 1031 is the 1031 through and through. You know, somebody can go out, if they can do it themselves and they want to go buy replacement property and they want to manage it, whether it be on a day-to-day basis or an asset management basis, big picture, I've bought it, I'm going to run it, eventually I'm going to sell it. Somebody can do that if that's what they're up for. If they're not up for that and they want to be passive and they want the ability to potentially diversify, depending on how they go, that's where the Delaware Statutory Trust fits into it. So the Delaware Statutory Trust as an entity doesn't mean that the real estate is in Delaware. And really the tie to Delaware is because Delaware is a fairly business-friendly state. And through, and it's a DST, Delaware Statutory Trust. So it's a trust, just like somebody would have a trust. You know, there's different ways to own real estate. People can own real estate as a trust. People can own real estate as an LLC. People can own real estate as a partnership, LP. People can own real estate as a corporation. People can own it as an individual. People can own it as tenants in common, joint tenants with rights of survivorship, husband and wife. There's some overlap with those last few things that I mentioned. But those are ways to own real estate. The Delaware Statutory Trust is a way to own real estate. However, years back, a bunch of people that were immersed in 1031 exchanges and effectively syndications of large real estate deals. So again, going back to the very beginning, large real estate deals, fractional ownership. A bunch of people involved with that petitioned the IRS for what ultimately resulted in what's called a revenue ruling. And specifically, it's called Revenue Ruling 2004-86. That means it's part of the Internal Revenue Code relative to 1031 exchanges. And it says that Delaware statutory trusts are investment vehicles that people can exchange into and exchange out of. And then from there, the Delaware statutory trust is a way of owning real estate where investors can participate fractionally for their 1031 exchanges. And now, just to clarify, as clients, one thing is really important that I think should be, you know, focused back to the 1031. For the 1031 itself mechanically, you have to buy replacement property in the same format as the way you've sold it. So if you sell it as an LLC, that LLC is going to be buying the replacement property in most cases. You know, there's always certain exceptions. But if you sell as a corporation, that corporation is going to buy the replacement property. That's what they're looking for. So as clients, when people invest in Delaware statutory trusts, as clients, as investors, I have husband and wife. I have joint tenants with rights of survivorship. I have corporations, I have partnerships, I have LLCs that invest as my clients into Delaware statutory trust. And by the way, I also have trusts that invest into the Delaware statutory trust underneath it. So it's the beneficial ownership, it's beneficial interest that these investors have. So again, that's a lot of information, but one should know that the DSTs are a way for investors to invest in these properties for their 1031 exchange. But I should also note that I have a lot of people and entities as direct cash investors that might not have even had a 1031 exchange, but just like to invest in these real estate deals.
If somebody invests into a DST, can they invest back into a property later?
Absolutely. When these Delaware statutory trusts sell, call it 5 to 10 years after the investors go in, when this real estate sells, the manager of it will go to the investors in that Delaware statutory trust and they'll say, there's a sale that's upcoming. Do you want to take the proceeds and pay your taxes, or do you want to do a like-kind tax-deferred 1031 exchange? If one says, yeah, we want to do a 1031 exchange, then what they would do is they would give the manager of that real estate that's selling the contact information for their qualified intermediary, the people that are doing the 1031 on their behalf. And then the proceeds at closing for that sale would go to the qualified intermediary. And then they would at that point have the ability to reinvest the proceeds into other investment real estate. So whether they go down the road and they buy themselves a rental, or they invest in commercial property, if that's their price point and that's what they're into, they absolutely have the ability to do that. If they want to reinvest in Delaware statutory trust once again, then we obviously then could work with them on seeing where the market is and, you know, working on options as replacement property for another 1031 exchange.
What should people look for when they're looking at DSTs? Because it sounds like if you're investing in a DST, there's probably a lot to consider. So what should people look for?
It really depends. Our role in it, that's really our job. Our job is to work with each individual investor to determine what their situation is, you know, and what they're looking for. So somebody could know apartments and they could want apartments. Somebody could know apartments and not want apartments. Somebody could want to invest in name that they know on with net lease real estate, like Federal Express, for example, or something like it, medical related. These are all aspects of one's own exchange and investment profile that we as a firm, and I, as I do my day to day, work with investors to figure that out. So they could be, generally speaking, though, one is looking for a return on their investment. They're looking to, you know, there's going to be an annual distribution, which is a percentage that we really can't get into on this call, but there's going to be a pro forma in each deal. So the ruling document for these securitized real estate deals is called a PPM, a private placement memorandum. And that's going to have everything about each deal. So anytime I work with somebody and we start to talk about these deals, they get a private placement memorandum, which will have a pro forma, you know, with what that manager believes they see the deal looking like over time. They'll also have a discussion of the risk factors for that deal and a discussion of their business plan and what they're trying to accomplish through the ownership and ultimate sale of that real estate. So these are all things on a case-by-case basis that are specific to each that we'll work with our clients to figure out which makes sense. But annual distribution, typically paid monthly. The distributions are tax advantaged, just like their other investment real estate. In most cases, this is applied to Schedule E on their taxes. So getting benefits of depreciation and write-offs, et cetera. Corporations are a little bit different. Other ownership structures have a different reporting schedule, but same type of write-offs as their other investment real estate. So that's what they can look for their distributions. And then ultimately, they're going to hopefully be sold for a profit. And one of the interesting things about the Delaware Statutory Trust, unlike other types of private equity real estate, which is really, really interesting, the manager, you know, running the DSTs can't profit share when they sell. So that means that net of closing costs and the associated what's called a disposition fee, they can't profit share. So if somebody, let's just use that $100 million hypothetical building that we talked about at the front end of this call, that's a $100 million deal and it's sold net of associated closing costs for $115 million. And somebody invests $1 million, theoretically, they should expect thereabouts $1.15 million to move forward with whatever they do next. Potentially. So that's how it goes. So the manager can't profit share on these Delaware statutory trusts. Really important to know. And it's one of the very interesting and I think good things about the structure for investors. Certainly, there's always risks. Your capital is at risk. It's an investment. And people have to be comfortable, you know, with the risk of potentially not getting distributions, potentially loss of any or all principal. And these are all the things that one should know as a sophisticated investor through all investments. But that's something, again, over time, that if we're working with investors, we certainly want to clarify and bring to their attention, talk about it, and depending on the comfort level with each respective deal, proceed from there accordingly.
And then what other things should people consider, like fees and other things like that? What should people be looking at when they're comparing DSTs?
These are all parts of securitized real estate deals that one is always going to look at when they're considering it. And that's our job. You know, the fees are going to be there because it's a professionally managed deal. You know, they can't do it as philanthropy in most cases because they have to do their job. So these are all things that are part of the deals and they're unique. But for us, the way that we look at it, you know, one, through our due diligence, we're going to determine a lot of things about the deals to figure out if we even have a comfort level offering that deal to our clients. So if the deal doesn't get there, then it's not going to be offered. From there, we drill down to the ones that are on the platform. You know, from there, it's a case-by-case basis as to which deals might be appropriate for which investors. But we're going to walk them through how the deals are going to be set up. Certainly, you know, some people have an affinity for certain geographical locations, certain asset classes like property sectors, and all the things associated. Whoever's running the deal, what they're trying to accomplish, what they've done historically. These are things that together we're going to look at with our clients to determine what makes sense. So it's really the big picture. It's the real estate. It's how the deal is put together. It's who's running it all together for what potentially might come next.
Well, Jason, I really appreciate having you on the show here. Any kind of final thoughts or things we haven't talked about you think the listeners should really know about?
Obviously, it's important to educate oneself about the 1031 and the Delaware Statutory Trust. Again, that's hopefully one of the reasons that we're having this chat today. You know, that's our job. So if down the road, any of the listeners are interested in this, I'd be very, very happy to walk through the 1031 exchange and the Delaware Statutory Trust. But I think we've covered quite a bit. If this is an introduction to it, we've got way past 101 level on both 1031 exchanges and Delaware Statutory Trust, and it's a process. Nobody's going to get everything on the first pass. If we're going to work with clients, we're going to give them as much education over time so that they can determine if it's not for them. And, you know, if it's for them, then we dig in and we see what's what. But I think we covered a whole bunch on this conversation, really to the extent of a general discussion about the topics. Absolutely.
Jason, where can people find more about you and your company?
Company is K Properties and Investments. They can email me. My email address is Jason, J-A-S-O-N, at KPI1031.com. So Jason at K like kitten, P like property, I like igloo1031.com.
So it was a great, interesting interview with Jason Salmon. I really enjoyed that. This is kind of one of those interesting niche areas that a lot of people are probably not familiar with. And if you're not a real estate investor, you may not have even heard of this before. But now we get into the panel portion of the show where we bring in some of our experts to really talk about this from different perspectives. So we want to start with our very own Barbara Friedberg. How are you doing today, Barb?
Doing good, Kirk. Thanks for having me on.
Good. Well, glad to have you again. We also have our very own Megan Gorman. How are you doing today, Megan?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great. And we also have a blast from the past. We have Miranda Marquardt. How are you doing today,
Miranda? Heyo.
We managed to scrape some time for Miranda here from her campaigning, which probably can't talk about. I'm sure there's some rules about that. But I know she's really busy, so I'm glad to have you on the show this week, Miranda.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. It's very kind of you to let me pop in on occasion.
It's great. So let's kind of dig in here. Let's start from kind of like a high level, because I know there's a lot of people who are probably thinking like, this doesn't apply to me. I don't understand this. But let's start with Megan. You work with a lot of clients who have this, you know, who use this tool. How should people be thinking about, from the interview, how should people be thinking about this?
First of all, I thought the interview was interesting. I think 1031s and DSTs are interesting for people who want to invest in this space. But I think the thing I want to just touch on first is one of the basic principles of tax planning and tax philosophy. And we talk about this a lot in the high net worth space. And I think that this is a good type of investment to show it against. But when you're actually focused on true tax planning, it is all about what we tax professionals call timing issues. And what you're focused on is either accelerating income or deductions in order to gain a benefit or deferring taxation. And so this type of setup is in the latter category. It's about deferring taxation. And that's because when we look at things like rental properties, for most people, when they go to sell, there can be some really adverse tax consequences. You end up having to recapture depreciation, and that can get expensive. And so the ability to do something like a 1031 exchange can be really, really, really powerful because it allows us to defer income. And that's one of the best aspects of tax planning.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that because I think a lot of people think about tax. They think, well, we just want to pay the government as little as possible. And, you know, how do we get out of paying tax? And from what you're saying, it sounds like it's not really about that. It's just about the timing of it.
Exactly. You're working in a way to figure out how to defer the tax bill to a later point in time. And remember, you're looking at a variety of factors. And this is an important inflection point given where we are today in the sense that depending on the outcome of this presidential election, a lot of people, particularly people in the high net worth group, are focused on what's going to be their future tax rate. And so when you're making these types of timing decisions, you're using the data you have right now on where we are in taxes and trying to factor in where you believe tax rates will go. And so when you look at these types of vehicles that we're talking about here, it gives people a chance to make a decision to push taxation out into the future. And I think the idea of a 1031 exchange is an interesting one in general, right? Because a 1031 exchange allows someone who has commercial or a business or an investment property, not a personal residence, but something that is held out for business use, to take that property that if they sold, they might have some adverse tax consequences, and instead look to defer it by exchanging the property for a like kind property. And this is just sort of the basic concept before we add the DST. And so for a lot of people, it becomes appealing because if they own a rental property or they own an apartment complex or commercial building, which has significant adverse tax consequences, rolling everything into a similar like kind property means they don't have to recognize taxation. And when you're dealing with real estate, particularly with when you think about commercial buildings, apartment complexes, those types of buildings, people hold for years, for decades. And so decisions to defer taxation might not just benefit you in the short term, but it might have implications for decades.
Yeah, that's a really important point, is thinking out long term in the process, especially if you're real estate investors. So Barb, you're an experienced real estate investor. Like, what were your takeaways from this interview?
You know, I want to flip it back to Megan for just one quick question.
Okay.
An important concept that I'd like her to expound upon, which is, could you explain what recapture depreciation actually means? Because it not only applies to 1031 exchanges, for those of you who might have a home office and you're taking depreciation on your office expenses within the home, this factor comes into play as well.
Good point. So when you are holding a rental property, you clearly are taking an income, you're offsetting it with expenses. You might have a mortgage on it, you real estate taxes, insurance. You also will be taking depreciation. And depreciation is really just an accounting method of allocating the cost of an asset over its useful life. And so they're giving you the ability to show that part of the asset's useful life is being used up over time. So if you had a rental house, a house that you rented out, you can depreciate that over 27 and a half years. But what you have to think about when you're depreciating is you only depreciate the structure, not the land, because the land can't be depreciated. It's not using up its useful value while you are with the structure. So what happens when you sell a property is you've been getting this benefit of depreciation during the ownership of it. But what happens is when you sell a property, you have to recapture or reclaim the depreciation that you've taken on the property. And when you do that, you recapture it at a tax rate that is higher. And so it ends up making it expensive when you sell a rental property.
That's a great point. I think it's an area that probably is not talked about enough in terms of the recapture, as most people just think they can just push taxes off into the future and just not worry about it. But when the recapture comes in, they usually get a little surprise from their accountant because it's not something they're familiar with.
Yeah, and it's typically 25% on the federal side. So it can be significant. And, you know, when you've got people who are selling properties, you know, let's say you owned a commercial building in downtown San Francisco and you've owned it for 35 years, right? And you can depreciate commercial properties 39 years. That's going to be a big number, and recapturing it can really burn you. So if you think about the concept of these families and individuals who own these large buildings or large complexes or large commercial spaces that they've been renting out for years, the ability to defer the taxation to another generation can be really, really powerful.
Yeah, and it sounds like if you do it right, the next generation might not even have to pay that, right?
Or they continue to do the like-kind exchanges. This is not a concept that is new. This has been around a very long time, and people will continue to do like-kind exchanges with their property. Now, you have to know the rules of the like-kind exchange, because you have to be willing to identify the new property within a period of time and do the exchange. And so that's where a lot of people get tripped up, because there's certain requirements when you are doing a 1031 exchange that can burn you, whether it's failure to identify a new property within the prescribed period of time or buying a property that perhaps is less than what you're selling. And then you get this fun concept called boot. And boot is really that excess gain that you didn't roll into the new property. You do have to recognize it. So what I would tell anyone is, when you're dealing with these types of complex tax transactions, you really need a tax professional to help you. And there are also people who specialize in the 1031 space.
That's really the important thing, is you need to really find an expert in the space, because there are many reasons to do that, but the least of which is screwing up a transaction because you didn't do it right. It costs a huge amount of gain, and it's not worth it. Getting back to you, Barb, what were some of your takeaways from the interview?
I think the reason that Jason Salmon has his business is because this is a really complicated area. And the service that he is providing is, he will help you through it. So there are many, many real estate investors out there, big and small, who want to sell their property, but they don't want that big tax hit that will come upon sale. So the 1031 is a really viable way to defer those taxes. So this doesn't just apply to people who own these big real estate buildings. It can apply to, you know, Joe and Jane Public, who own a two-family in Cincinnati, Ohio, and they want to sell it, but they don't want to pay taxes. To be able to do a 1031 exchange means they are going to buy another property of like kind within this period of time and not pay all the taxes that would be due if they just sold it outright. So it's really a topic that's not discussed that much, but it has applicability across many levels of real estate ownership, not just the big guys.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. I know a lot of small investors use this successfully and have over decades. So it is something that's used quite frequently with real estate investors. Miranda, what were your thoughts from the interview? What were some of your takeaways?
What's been kind of said so far really makes a lot of sense in terms of, we talk about how a lot of the time regular folks don't have access to some of this information. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that maybe we don't even know what is available out there for us, which is what's great about having awesome experts like Barb and Megan on this podcast, because they can say like, hey, here are the possibilities. Yes, these can be complex transactions. And yes, you might need a little help to guide you through it, but getting that help to guide you through it can pay off big in the end. And so I think that's one of the big takeaways here is, okay, here are the possibilities. Now it's time to see if this is going to work for my situation, if this is going to work for me, and how can I get the professional help and insight that I need. I think one of the things we often forget here is that wealthy investors, whether it's in real estate or stocks or tax liens or whatever it is, wealthy investors have people help them manage their money and help them make the most of their money. And so I think, you know, when you're talking about these complex transactions, understanding that they are complex, but there are things you can do about it and you can get that kind of professional guidance to help you take the next step is really important.
Miranda, I think that you've hit the nail on the head, because one of the things that struck me in listening to this is when people hear about this concept, what they don't realize with wealthy investors is one of the reasons that Jason's firm is dealing with Delaware statutory trusts is Delaware is one of the states out there that really has a preferential body of law to use, not just for corporate, but in a lot of wealth planning decisions. If you're in the high net worth space right now, all you're hearing is the concept of Delaware, Delaware, Delaware. That's because, again, there is a really good body of law. And Delaware, as a state, has gone out and really, they've been creative there with their body of laws. And, you know, they've been able to create these things called Delaware statutory trusts. And what makes it unique, which makes it so appealing to high net worth investors, is these are the only statutory trusts that are explicitly recognized by the IRS as a legal entity that can facilitate a 1031 exchange. And so when you're a high net worth investor and you're looking to do some of this, what you don't want is you don't want to deal with the IRS any more than you have to. You want to make sure everything you're doing is above board and compliance wise. And so knowing that Delaware has sort of forged these types of trusts, that they're protected, that, you know, the IRS has signed off on it, can give a high net worth investor peace of mind. And so one of the things I would tell anyone out there as they consider any type of investments using trusts or entities is entity is important, and look, the entity domicile is important. What state you choose to form an entity or invest in an entity can often have long-term implications for you.
How should people look at that? Because I see this a lot where people read something in a blog or an article and they say, oh, I need this or I need that. And, you know, I know in Massachusetts, like an LLC, people just say, oh, we need to use a like a Nevada LLC or a Delaware LLC, and you still got to pay the fee to the state of Massachusetts for LLC fees as a foreign filing fee. So regardless of whether it's domestic or foreign, so you're not saving money on the filing fee. But How should people be looking at the state-to-state kind of decision? Because there are a lot of states with different laws, and you, as an individual, you can't know them all.
And Kirk, you're right. Like, I mean, I'm sitting, you know, in California, and if you open up a LLC, you send a check for $800 immediately. Although they have just changed that rule, but the $800 fee is still there on an annual basis. What you want to do is find someone who specializes in this area. You're not supposed to know all the rules, but what you need to know is what are the questions to ask. And really, the questions I would ask are, what are the benefits of this to me? And what are the cons of setting this up? And what's so unique about that state? So when we think about Delaware, and I'm going to take you into estate planning for a bit, but Delaware is a unique state on the estate planning front, and why it's getting a lot of press today is because they allow for dynasty trust planning, and they do not have a rule against perpetuity. For instance, if I had children and grandchildren, I could set up trusts for them, but that trust will be subject in California to the rule against perpetuity. So at a certain point in time, that trust must end and disperse itself. But on the estate planning side in Delaware, that's not the case. The trust can go on in perpetuity. So if you think about it, if you're a very wealthy person, I see people do this all the time when they're worth, you know, $80, $100, $150, $200 million. The idea of putting something in trust in Delaware and letting it live perpetually is pretty powerful. Now, when we look at the Delaware statutory trust, one of the big benefits in doing this 1031 exchange into a Delaware statutory trust is that the profits have to be distributed to investors on a quarterly basis. So if you think about this, right, and you're thinking about how do I create passive income streams or predictable income streams, which is really important in retirement planning, that's one of the best, you know, the biggest pros about it is that you get this predictable quarterly income stream on profit.
That's an important part of this too, especially as real estate investors. A lot of real estate investors invest for the cash flow. So it's really important to be able to get that. So Barb, with your experience, have you ever used the 1031 with your real estate investments?
I had thought about it a lot. I thought, oh, this is such a great idea. And I haven't invested in individual real estate properties in quite a while. But when I was in that type of investing, I thought about, oh gosh, I've got to do a 1031. And I probably shouldn't admit this because it's showing how I let my fear drive my investment decisions. But they sounded so complicated to me. And this was decades ago. So it was in the 80s. And I was a lot younger, obviously, and I was scared. I knew what they are. I understood their benefits. And I thought, how am I going to do this? The rules seem too complicated, and I was overwhelmed. And so I avoided those. And again, I have not used K Properties, obviously, or Jason Salmon's company. But I think today there are so many more resources to help investors who have a real estate property or two or more that want to sell and buy something else to participate in the 1031 exchange. I think it's an awesome opportunity within the tax code.
Can I just Barb? I think you bring up something. I do think 1031s are complex. And what I often find is people come to me with the idea before we've even run the numbers on what the true tax piece would be if they just simply sold. So I wanted to just stop there and just remind people that before you go down this idea of using a 1031 as cool and as sexy as they can be, don't be afraid first to ask your tax professional, what would the actual tax consequences be if I sold it? Just because once you go down the 1031 path, you're tied into a process.
Well, and the other thing is, and I just went through this because I just sold a business that had been around for a very, very long time. And there were some significant tax consequences. And so for those of us that abhor paying taxes, which, gosh, is probably everyone, it's really painful when you get a super big tax bill. But you need to look at that like Warren Buffett does, which is if you have a financial gain, you're going to have to pay taxes on it at some point. There's no avoiding that. That's how our government is set up. So maybe you can defer them. And Megan, you touched on this. Maybe you can defer them down the pike, like with your IRA, you defer taxes while the money is growing and compounding there. But at some point, you have to pay the piper. And that is a reality that we have to accept.
A lot of people are focused on the tax and they're not focused on the investment. And I want to kind of pull it back because I think it's an important lesson to talk about here is I hear this a lot, and let's talk about individual stocks, where somebody will say, well, I don't want to sell my shares because I have to pay a bunch of tax. And when you let the tax tail wag the investment dog, you kind of put yourself in a potentially precarious position. I remember when I was starting in the industry back in, I think this was in like early 2000, where tech stocks were just starting to plummet. And I remember at the time we had one of my associates next to me was working with a client of his who had ISOs or their incentive stock options. And he was trying to exercise and hold and for the long-term capital gains. And the stock price just kept going down. I don't remember if the stock went to zero, but it was pretty close. And he not only did he lose all that money, but he owed taxes on top of it. You know, that was a situation where, you know, sometimes it's okay to pay the tax. And no one wants to pay the tax. I mean, maybe some people do. By the way, those of you who do, apparently, I don't know if it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago, you used to not be able to pay more than your fair share. Now you actually can. They've changed the rule, which allows you to do that. With stuff like that, you just have to understand, like, yes, as you know, Barb and Meg were saying, you have to pay your tax, minimizing it, deferring it, accelerating it, whatever you need to be. But just be aware that you need to have gains to pay tax. So make sure you're taking your gains and make sure that is your top priority and focus on the taxes as a part of the process, but not as the primary reason for it. I guess we can kind of wrap up the show here. Miranda, final thoughts on this topic?
I haven't had a lot to contribute this go, but that's okay because I've learned a lot. So that's always nice. I think the main thing here is that what you said, Kirk, is don't let the tax wag your investment, right? The tax tail wag your investment dog. Because the reality of the situation is as we've said, we're all going to pay taxes. And honestly, it's not the total end of the world. You know, taxes pay for things like roads and our military. So it's cool, I guess, to some degree. But in the end, you have to look at it in terms of, okay, what is the investment? What are my potential gains? And kind of look at taxes as part of, you know, the cost of doing business. And yes, we definitely want to limit our tax liability. We want to reduce what we're paying in taxes, but don't let the fear of paying a dollar in tax keep you from potentially receiving $100 in income.
Where can people find more about you?
Yeah, you can find me at MirandaMarquette.com. I'm also on the Twitters and the Instagram at MMarquette. So yeah, you can check me out there. I write about money on the internet and how I use investing to live my best life.
Thanks for coming on, Miranda. Barb, what about you? Final thoughts?
I think this tax topic is so important, and I recommend that everyone learn, read as much as you can about how to keep your taxes to a minimum. But realize also, as Miranda just so eloquently said, and we have all been discussing, that taxes are a necessary part of making money. And so you can pay your minimum, but realize you're going to have to pay something. And just accept that as the cost of making money and of making our society run. So my name is Barbara Friedberg. You can find me at Robo Advisor Bros and Barbara Friedberg Personal Finance. Thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Thanks for coming on, Barb. And Megan, final thoughts.
Anything you do like this, consult your tax professional before you do it. But also never be afraid to ask questions of how something's going to benefit you or how something might have a negative consequence. Because all tax strategies can sound sexy at the start, but you know, the devil's in the details. And you want to understand what you're truly getting into. So I'm Megan Gorman. You can find me at thewealthintersection.com or on Twitter at @wealthintersect. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager at Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, we'll have access to the show notes, resources, and archive shows. If you want to learn more about this topic and other topics on the episodes, we'll have all the links, the appropriate links for you to learn more. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the guests that you're going to want to hear. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.